Penguin Random House Audio presents The Demon of Unrest, a saga of hubris, heartbreak, and heroism at the dawn of the Civil War, by Eric Larson. Read for you by Will Patton and Eric Larson. Slavery with us is no abstraction, but a great and vital fact. Without it, our every comfort would be taken from us. Our wives, our children, made unhappy. Education, the light of knowledge, all lost. And our people ruined forever. Nothing short of separation from the Union can save us. Arthur Perrin O'Hayne to President James Buchanan, December 22nd. 1860. We must settle this question now, whether in a free government the minority have the right to break up the government whenever they choose. If we fail, it will go far to prove the incapability of the people to govern themselves. Abraham Lincoln remarked to Private Secretary John Hay, May 1861. Is anything worth it? This fearful sacrifice, this awful penalty we pay for war? Mary Boykin Chestnut, Journal, July 26, 1864.
Dark Magic, A Note to Readers. I was well into my research on the saga of Fort Sumter and the advent of the American Civil War when the events of January 6, 2021 took place. As I watched the Capitol assault unfold on camera, I had the eerie feeling that present and past had merged. It is unsettling that in 1861, two of the greatest moments of national dread centered on the certification of the Electoral College vote and the presidential inauguration. I was appalled by the attack, but also riveted. I realized that the anxiety, anger, and astonishment that I felt would certainly have been experienced in 1860-61 by vast numbers of Americans. With this in mind, I set out to try to capture the real suspense of those long-ago months when the country lurched toward catastrophe. Propelled by hubris, duplicity, false honor, and an unsatisfiable craving on the part of certain key actors for personal attention and affirmation. Many voices at the time of Sumter warned of civil war, but few had an inkling of what that might truly mean, and certainly none would have believed that any such war could take the lives of 750,000 Americans. At the heart of the story is a mystery that still confounds. How on earth did South Carolina, a primitive, scantily populated state in economic decline, become the fulcrum for America's greatest tragedy? And even more bewildering, what malignant magic brought Americans on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line to the point where they could actually imagine the wholesale killing of one another? This is a work of nonfiction. As always, anything between quotation marks comes from some form of historical document. Likewise, any reference to a gesture, smile, or other physical action comes from an account by one who made it or witnessed it. In places, I have corrected anachronistic spelling, capitalization, and punctuation to conform with modern usage. For example, I turned ampersands into and, but only where that meaning was obvious. Lincoln's charming misspellings remain unaltered. Racially charged terms have been redacted in the audiobook just as they are in the print version. I invite you now to step into the past, to that time of fear and dissension, and experience the passion, heroism, and heartbreak, even humor, as if you were living in that day and did not know how the story would end. I suspect your sense of dread will be all the more pronounced in light of today's political discord, which, incredibly, has led some benighted Americans to whisper once again of secession and civil war. Eric Larson, New York, 2024.
A boat in the dark. The oars were audible before the boat came into view, this despite a noisy wind that coarsened the waters of the bay. It was very late on a black night. The rain, according to one account, fell in torrents, and the wind howled, weird-like and drearily. In recent weeks the weather had been erratic, seductively vernal one day, bone-rackingly cold the next. One morning there was snow. For a week a strong gale had scoured the coast. The four enslaved men rowing the boat made steady progress despite the wind and chop, and hauled their cargo, three white Confederate officers, with seeming ease. They covered the distance from Charleston to the fortress in about 45 minutes. Until recently, a big lantern incorporating the latest in Fresnel lenses had capped the fort's lighthouse, but in preparing for war, Army engineers had moved it. Now, the lantern stood elevated on trestles at the center of the enclosed grounds, the parade, where it lit the interior faces of the surrounding 50-foot walls and the rumps of giant cannon facing out through ground-level casements. From afar, at night, in the mist, the light transformed the fortress into an immense cauldron steaming with pale smoke. The boat reached its wharf at 12:45 a.m., Friday, April 12th, 1861, destined to be the single most consequential day in American history. Over the last 113 days, the fort's commander, Major Robert Anderson, and his garrison of U.S. Army regulars, along with a cadre of men under Captain John G. Foster of the Army Corps of Engineers, had transformed it from a cluttered relic into an edifice of death and destruction. It was still drastically undermanned. Designed to be staffed by 650 soldiers, it now had only 75, including officers, enlisted men, engineers, and members of the regimental band. But its guns were ready, nested within and atop its walls. Also, five large cannon had been mounted on makeshift platforms in the parade and pointed skyward to serve as mortars, these capable of throwing explosive shells into Charleston itself. In those 113 days, this fortress, named for Thomas Sumter, a Revolutionary War hero, had become a profoundly dangerous place to invade and could have resisted attack quite possibly forever, but for one fatal flaw. It was staffed by men, and men had to eat. The food supply, cut off by Confederate authorities, had dwindled to nearly nothing. Anderson was 55 years old, with a wife, Eliza, known universally as Eba, three daughters, and a one-year-old son, also named Robert. Anderson was clean-shaven, rare for the time, and this helped impart to his face a pleasant openness, very unlike the hollow axe-handle aspect of his Confederate opponent across the bay, his friend and former pupil, General P.G.T. Beauregard, who had taken command of all South Carolina military activities. Their relationship was courteous and cordial, almost warm, despite Beauregard's obvious willingness to kill Anderson and all his men if it meant furthering the cause of Southern independence. Anderson adored his family and mourned the separation from them that was so often required by the Army. Thanks to income from Eba's family, they lived a life they could not have afforded on his salary alone. They owned a house on West 9th Street in New York, but with Anderson's rising notoriety, Eba and the children moved into the nearby Brevoort House Hotel, a luxurious five-story structure on Fifth Avenue. Their daughters went to boarding school in New Jersey, a measure meant apparently to ease the burden of child-rearing for Eba, who suffered from an indeterminate chronic illness, which Anderson in one letter described as her long-continued indisposition. Eba's condition made Anderson all the more attentive to her. "What would I not give to know that you passed a comfortable night and that you feel much better this morning," he wrote on one occasion. He was prone to loving endearments. "I do not know what I should do without you, my precious pet," or simply, "my precious," or "my own dear little wife." To save her the physical strain of writing letters, he proposed a pact. He would continue to write to her every day in multi-page diary-like accounts, but she would be obligated to write to him only once a week.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?